Let's proceed to San Juan versus School District of West New York. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Lester Taylor from the Taylor Law Group, head of the appellant West New York Board of Education, office located in Massachusetts.
Good afternoon, Jeff. I'm representing Kisura and GPSA, New Jersey Principal of the Supervisor Association. Your Honors, William P. Hannon of the law firm Hawthorne Cohen, D.C., on behalf of Mrs. Curie, New Jersey Education Association.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honor. Evan Goldman and Kelly Smith from the law firm of Goldman Davis, Krumholtz, and Dillon, Hackensack, New Jersey, on behalf of the respondent of Modest San Juan.
Welcome, counsel. Be seated, everyone. I had the NJEA going for the NJ Principals and Supervisors Association. Did you prefer a different order? Okay. Mr. Taylor, please.
Thank you again, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I am here today, interestingly enough, to argue a case before this esteemed body, this New Jersey Supreme Court, for a matter that I essentially lost at the arbitration level. And we lost it from a standpoint of, and the record reflects, that the tenure charges that were filed against Ms. San Juan sought her removal from her position as vice principal and from her employment in the West New York School District. But essentially, she was removed from one position, but reinstated into or allowed to keep her teaching position, for which she also had separately earned tenure. So again, we saw her immediate dismissal. It's important to note for background purposes that Ms. San Juan was a 23-year employee of the West New York School District. Approximately 19 of those years, she served as a teacher in the school district. She was then promoted to assistant principal at Memorial High School, and she served from that position from 2016 to about 2023. Now, in education law, positions are separately tenurable. If from a certificated staff standpoint, you have teachers, you can be tenured as a vice principal, as an assistant principal, as a business administrator, et cetera. And as you move up the ladder, after you acquire tenure, it used to be 3 years in a day, now it's 4 years in a day, you can acquire what's called promotional tenure. So again, Ms. San Juan had tenure in two separate positions and two separate titles. And I think that's just very important to note from a background standpoint. It's also important to note that the arbitration award was affirmed or confirmed by the trial division after it was challenged by Mr. Goldman. The matter was appealed, and the appellate division overturned the arbitration award, essentially saying that the arbitrator exceeded his authority by demoting Ms. San Juan. But it also was very troubling because on remand, the appellate division limited the arbitrator's power, role, responsibility pursuant to statute in reconsidering the penalty and limited the arbitrator to a mere consideration of what, if any, additional suspension and or reduction in compensation rather than allowing the arbitrator to reconsider everything. So we're kind of here arguing two facts or two issues. One, that the arbitration award was valid on its face and the arbitrator did not exceed his authority, and or stated differently, if you believe the arbitrator did, that the matter should be remanded and the arbitrator be left to his devices, quite frankly, pursuant to the statute. It's important to note that the appellate court essentially based its decision on the premise that the arbitrator was, quote, mistaken, unquote, insofar as the demotion was a remedy. And that's at page 12, section B of the appellate division decision. And so again, I'm going to come back to that in a little while, but the words "was mistaken" were relied upon by the appellate division at page 12, section B. Now again, we all here acknowledge that this is an issue of first impression that was also noted aptly by the appellate division, namely whether an arbitrator has the authority to dismiss or rather reduce an employee and demote them essentially pursuant to 18A6-16. Now it's important to note that under our system of justice and laws in New Jersey, when it comes to arbitrations, there are essentially four grounds upon which a court may vacate an arbitrator's decision pursuant to NJSA 2A:24-8. Now, I would submit, and I think we all can agree, that sections A, B, and C do not apply here. There was no corruption, fraud, evident impartiality, et cetera, or misconduct. But the question is whether there was, or whether the arbitrator exceeded and or so imperfectly executed his power that a mutual, final, and definite award on the subject matter was not made. It is respectfully submitted that the word mistake that was relied upon by the appellate division is not in NJSA 2A:24-8. Arbitrator Zirkle's award was mutual, arbitrator Zirkle's award was final, and his award was definite upon the subject matter presented to him, which was whether the employee should be removed from her position. She was removed from her vice principal position. She just so happened to have tenure, 16 years of it, as a teacher, to which the arbitrator removed her, or stated differently, demoted her to that position. So at best, again, the award was final, mutual, and definite. At worst, it was reasonably debatable. Is it debatable whether removal means removal from the entire district? In this cancel culture we're in, you know, does removal mean you're out? Or does removal mean that we have options that, quite frankly, are more humane, more empathetic, they're more reasonable based upon the facts and the context of a case in each individual scenario? So again, the appellate division respectfully, other than relying upon and referring to, dictionary definitions, did not rely upon any binding past precedent. And admittedly, there is none that is binding. There is some that's persuasive, that is very instructive, that I think is reasonable and applicable here. But there was no past precedent, or binding precedent rather, other than dictionary definitions and an arguable interpretation of the plain reading of the statute saying that an arbitrator cannot demote someone. But again, the statute doesn't say they can't demote someone. And so to the extent that the arbitrator relied upon the lack of language saying he couldn't do it, a statute doesn't say, have to say what he can do. And we'll come back to that in a moment as well. Your Honors, the present matter, again, is an issue of first impression. Arbitrator Zirkle's exercise of his authority in fashioning a remedy, it was consistent with applicable law. The primary holding or precedent in this area is the matter of In re Fulcomer, 93 NJ Super 404. That case essentially stands for the concept of equitable mitigation. We believe that case, which is still good law, some 40, 50, some odd, actually 60, I think it is, my math is off, 60 years later. And that case, without limitation, stands for the proposition at page 422 that the commissioner then and arbitrator now has an affirmative decision to make to impose a proper remedy. That penalty should be based upon the findings as to the nature and gravity of the offenses. Under all the circumstances involved, any evidence as to provocation, extenuation, or aggravation should take into account consideration of any harm or injurious effect the teacher's conduct may have had on the maintenance of discipline and the proper administration of the school system. And so we would again refer to that case and rely upon it where it says common sense dictates, and this is some 60 years ago, but it's still applicable now. Common sense dictates that the arbitrator must have and exercise the power to impose the penalty gauged by the evidence before him at the hearing. Arbitrator Zirkle presided over 2 days of hearing testimony, and in coming to his remedy, the penalty that was imposed, he relied upon testimony, and he summarized witness statements of Mr. Guerrero, the former principal of the high school, Mr. Walrath, Mr. Roth, as to, in their testimony, the detrimental impact of plaintiff's or respondent's conduct in terms of her assistant principal role. But arbitrator Zirkle further found that there were mitigating circumstances, and there was discussion about it in his arbitration award as to while there was a leakage, I'll call it, of the video of the incident, that it was kind of contained to the executive level, the superintendent, the principals. It hadn't gotten to the buildings and other teachers and other staff members. So the arbitrator basically said it would be fair, it would be equitable, or alternatively, it would be draconian to remove this person's 23-year career because of one, no pun intended, slip-up. And so allowed her to keep her job, keep her career, recognizing that it would be harder to, or rather extreme, to terminate her from the entire her entire career. There is additional authority in case law that the arbitrator relied upon that's consonant with this particular matter. And this matter is distinguishable from another case that is a good law in the Serapompa matter, 228NJ4, whereas in this case, the arbitrator did not, he did not impermissibly convert or apply some heightened standard to the situation at hand. In that case, the court, or the arbitrator rather, imposed a sexual harassment standard for a civil or employment-based conduct unbecoming case. And the court found that the arbitrator did exceed his authority by imposing that heightened standard. But in this case here, the arbitrator simply relied upon the Fulcrumer standards and relied upon the premise of equitable mitigation with respect to the award that was entered. We'd also add that the tenure charges in this matter, there were basically four separate counts. All of them were some semblance of conduct unbecoming. Each and every one of them sought the employee's removal from her position and or her immediate dismissal. We would argue that, again, Arbitrator Zirkel did that. He removed her from her position of assistant principal. We're sitting here today in what I jokingly call an unholy alliance of the NJEA, the NJPSA, and a board attorney. We very seldomly agree on anything, very seldomly. As I indicated, I lost this case in that we wanted her removal, and she was demoted. But in review and consultation with my client, particularly in looking at the factors of the standards to vacate an arbitration award, there may have been a mistake. There may have been a differing interpretation of the law, but that reasonably debatable standard does not warrant the award being vacated. And quite frankly, the trial court agreed with that, and we were able to take that.
Counsel, you said at your opening remarks, I didn't want to stop you there, that this matter should be remanded if your argument prevails. Why is that? Why wouldn't the arbitrator's award simply be reinstated?
I was trying to have it both ways, Your Honor. Because so to the extent that there are two issues that are before the court today, one, does an arbitrator have the authority to demote an employee under the Tenure Employees Hearing Law, NJSA 18A:6-10, and NJSA 18A:6-16. If the court answers in the affirmative, yes, case is closed, the award is reinstated. If the court answers no, or rather the arbitrator exceeded his authority, then the question is, on remand, is the arbitrator limited to the remedial purposes or the penalty purposes, limited to just considering what, if any, additional suspension and or reduction in compensation? Or can the arbitrator consider all options available, i.e. removal from all positions in the district?
So you're arguing that if you win on question one, we don't get to question two at all?
Correct.
We only get to question two because the appellate division's holding stated that the arbitrator would then be limited on remand.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. Our adversary in his brief took a couple of shots at the arbitrator with respect to his experience, lack of knowledge in the field of education law. I would just point the court to, number one, when Teach NJ in 2012 was enacted to essentially assign matters to arbitrators for the effective and the efficient handling of tenure cases in particular, rather than being handled by an Office of Administrative Law Judges. Part of the purpose, respectfully to OAL judges who are responsible for various different divisions and manners of state government, the arbitrators, pursuant to the statute, are among a panel of 50 select individuals in the state of New Jersey. 16 of those arbitrators are selected by the NJEA, 6 from the American Federation of Teachers, 18 from the New Jersey School Boards Association, and 10 from the New Jersey Principal and Supervisors Association. Those arbitrators are statutorily required to have a heightened level of knowledge of school law based upon how they were selected by that panel and continued training that they are required to have.
Does any of this matter if the real question before us is whether the arbitrator exceeded the authority granted to or imperfectly executed it?
It matters just from the tangential standpoint that the arbitrator was a very well-informed a knowledgeable individual with respect to his powers and role in fashioning a remedy. And I'll move on from that if you would like.
A well-informed arbitrator could get it wrong, and a poorly informed arbitrator could get it right. We need to figure out what happened on the merits question, no?
Very fair, Mr. Chief Justice. If I may move on just with respect to a few statutory matters, because again, school law is becoming more complex. And more, there's an intricate web of statutes that govern, as I alluded to earlier, teacher tenure and or administrator tenure. The controlling statute is 18A6-10 regarding removal or dismissal or reduction in compensation, which states that no person shall be dismissed or reduced in compensation while they're under tenure.
It seems that the appellate division, the heart of the appellate division decision is that there's more to demotion than a reduction, than a salary reduction, and the statute doesn't say that there can be a demotion as a remedy, but only terminated or depriving the employee of salary, and that and demotion doesn't fit into that.
Understood. And I would argue that there's more to a termination than a demotion. And so respectfully, be careful what you ask for, because if there's going to be that literal interpretation, then more arbitrators would be left with no other choice other than to separate people from their positions rather than exercise reasonable and informed judgment based upon the particular facts and circumstances of each case.
And that may be so, but our job is not, of course, to second guess the statute. It's to interpret the statute. So why is the appellate division wrong in saying that the statute doesn't provide for a demotion, because a demotion is much more or more than a salary reduction?
For two reasons. One, as I referenced earlier, with respect to NJSA 2A:24-8, the appellate division at page, bear with me 1 second, please. Page 12, section B of the opinion, Judge Sumner's utilized the word, the arbitrator made a mistake. That was his words, made a mistake. NJSA 2A:24-8, subsection D, which is probably the most relevant here, exceeding and or so imperfectly executing powers. The word mistake is not there. And so to the extent that the arbitrator made a mistake, it's not the court's role to second guess and or reconsider matters outside of the statutory confines in 2A:24-8.
Aren't you also arguing that under 18A:6-16, the use of the words, if however, comma, he shall determine that such charges is sufficient to warrant dismissal or reduction in salary of the person charged, he shall refer the case to an arbitrator pursuant to blah, 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 was really just a condition for when a case can get referred to an arbitrator, and not a limit on the power of the arbitrator to award a remedy if the arbitrator finds that the charges were proven.
Thank you, because that's the transition to my next line of argument, which is on page 15 of the arbitrator's award. He in fact says, after asking the parties to brief the issue in their post-hearing submissions, do I have the authority, which I think was a big hint, that I'm not going to terminate this person from all of their jobs in the district, so do I have the authority to demote her? Stated differently, do I have the authority to remove her, to use a statutory term, remove her from her assistant principal job and allow her to keep the job that she has 16 plus 5 or 6 more years when you tack on that time of tenure as a teacher? And so you're right.
Are you using the word remove as identical to dismissal?
Yes.
But earlier you were suggesting that remove could have different implications.
Well, it could. But again, the statutory term is removal. It doesn't say fire. It doesn't say terminate.
Well,
it says remove.
In 6-16, we're talking about sufficient to warrant dismissal or reduction in the salary of a person charged. We're not talking about removal.
So I'll use the term dismissal then. So even dismissal from her vice principal position, a position which she has tenure in, but she also, as any other employee who works their way up the chain, the ladder, would have tenure in underlying positions as well. And so the arbitrator removes her from her job.
Your use of the word removal
or dismiss
could allow for room to be removed from one and placed in another.
Or dismissed from one and placed in another, yes.
Dismissal has a more of a finite definition in terms of once you're dismissed from the position, it appears that you would be dismissed from the entire school district.
Well, then, if that's the case, and I don't disagree with that per se, and that's where there's the Hackensack case, where there was an arbitration in Hackensack where there was a question as to the arbitrator's intent in removing the athletic director or dismissing the athletic director. And the parties sought clarification from the arbitrator. Did you intend, Mr. Arbitrator, to dismiss the person from just the AD's job or all of his jobs? And the response was the arbitrator opined, not saying it's binding here because it's not, that he doesn't have the authority to demote, so he's removing him from all of his positions. So we go back to question A, which is before this court. If you agree that the arbitrator exceeded his authority by demoting the employee, by dismissing her from only one position versus everything, then we would submit that it should go back to the arbitrator and he basically be directed that since you dismissed her from your assistant principal job, that has the effect of dismissing her from everything.
Let's go back to the question of authority that
yes.
has been framed. Section 16 talks about what's needed to, quote, refer the case to an arbitrator. Is there a statute elsewhere that expressly says arbitrators can only dismiss or reduce salary and have no other authority?
No, there isn't. And so that's what's interesting because, again, the
Is there the any standard, statute that talks about any remedy that the arbitrator can and cannot impose?
Our argument and our interpretation, my interpretation of the statute, is that if the commissioner believes or in the commissioner's opinion, the charges are sufficient to warrant dismissal or reduction, he or she can refer them to an arbitrator. The arbitrator shall determine if such charge is sufficient to warrant dismissal or reduction. But again, those terms in my interpretation are, again, the barrier, the gate, the bar you have to get over to get into the courthouse, so to speak, to get into the arbitration table. But once the case goes to arbitration, pursuant to our laws in the state of New Jersey, arbitrators have wide powers to fashion remedies, whether it be contractual and or statutorily. And there's nothing in any statute or any case that affirmatively or definitively says an arbitrator shall not or otherwise cannot demote, remove, dismiss someone to something less than termination. And there's dozens of cases pre and post 2012, TeachNJ, where half a dozen of which I handled. Arbitrator reinstates someone, substance abuse evaluation, conditions it upon last chance agreement, conditions it upon no social media contact with minors. So there's a whole lot of remedies that arbitrators, which counsel doesn't contest, that are not in the statute, but are done every single day. Yes.
And I think the statute you were referring to earlier with regard to the composition of the arbitration panel, that particular statute is 6-17.1. That talks about the panel, membership, assignment of cases, proceedings, timeliness, when the arbitrator shall issue a decision, time frames for the proceedings, but says nothing about what the arbitrator is confined to only dismissal or reduction in salary.
Nothing. It's just those terms, dismissal or reduction, or just the concepts. It has to be serious enough, because again, an employee can be a verbal reprimand, a written reprimand, an increment withholding. So there's all types of discipline that can happen at the administrative level and or the board level. The tenure charge process is for the ultimate sacrifice, which is termination. It's almost like a death penalty case. Just because the court doesn't impose death doesn't mean the court can't impose life in prison. And in this matter, it's also somewhat analogous that if the arbitrator did make a mistake, then perhaps the appropriate remedy would be or could be similar to the Hackensack case. The parties could have, probably should have, sought a clarification and or a motion for reconsideration, which is filed in the municipal court, or rather superior courts of our state. And that same judge has the right and power to reconsider their and or clarify, confirm their position. And so if upon knowledge, let's say, again, there's a bright line rule that an arbitrator shall not, based upon the appellate division's decision in this case, does not have the authority to demote someone, to remove them or dismiss them from one position, but not all positions, then that arbitrator should be given that guidance and told to impose a penalty consistent with the court's now new issue of first impression interpretation of the law, which now would be law.
Yes, in your experience, if there's no guidance, there's no statute, there's no place where an arbitrator can draw these remedies from, where do they normally develop these, the list of remedies from that they use in typical arbitration cases?
Well, I think you start from the extreme of dismissal, and then you have economic penalties of either a suspension or withholding of an increment. It's important to note that in this case, you know, just in salary guides or public information, but the petitioner or the employee in this case basically suffered about a $27,000 per year just that first year hit. So from an assistant principal to a teacher job was $27,000. Let's say 150 to 125, right, the first year. She worked for about 23 years. She probably has a 10, 15 more years of employment. The penalty in this case was worth upwards of $500,000. So the arbitrator could have suspended her for 5 years to get that value, so to speak. But then how would that impact the orderly operation of a school where you have a vacancy for 5 years with someone that has a right to come back? How do you operate? How do you administer? You have to hire somebody. That new person would get tenure by the time the other person comes back. So that wouldn't be fair or equitable or reasonable in this matter. And so, again, if the arbitrator who thought this case was worth $500,000 hit to this person's pocket by demoting her, because they get raises every year, too, it will expand and compound. But you know what? I'll split the baby, so to speak. I'll be empathetic. I'll recognize that this person has an otherwise stellar record. But it does warrant punishment, just short of termination. But
as you mentioned, there were other reasons why taking her out of the principal, assistant principal, the supervisor structure in the school, but leaving her in as a teacher may have made sense, including the fact that the administrators or some of the administrators saw this video, and perhaps students didn't, and other teachers may not have. And also the fact that she was no longer in a position of authority over teachers after this incident.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm not even going to second guess, because just because you were a good teacher 5 years ago doesn't mean you'd be a good one now. I mean, I was a good associate, but I'd probably be horrible now. So I don't know if that would be relevant, but the reality is she got to keep her job.
The arbitrator could have dismissed her.
Exactly.
And what did you ask for in the arbitration?
Dismissal. And similar to the Hackensack case, when the arbitrator invited the parties, asked the parties to brief the issue, can he demote her? Can he remove her from the AP position to a lower position? Yeah, we argued that you shouldn't. We argued that there's nothing that says you can. But again, that's just an argument. That's what lawyers do.
And that was. Sorry, can you clarify that? So originally, you requested dismissal. Then the arbitrator requested supplemental briefing on what?
Well, post-hearing brief. So rather than doing an oral closing, we do post-hearing submissions.
Okay.
And one of the points that were in conference, in terms of considering and fashioning a remedy based upon the context here, and if you look at a lot of the other tenure charge cases that are out there, every district is seeking removal. But in looking at the facts and the circumstances, even if just cause is established to confirm a wrong, so to speak, does that wrong equal or warrant termination? And in more instances than not, the answer is no, quite frankly. And so that's how you get into these middle grounds.
You got a little away from
question. Yeah. Right. So what did the arbitrator request post-hearing briefing on?
Whether an arbitrator has the power to demote an employee.
And your answer was what?
Well, our argument was there's nothing that says you can, there's nothing that says you can't.
And your colleagues on the other side of the aisle said?
I let him speak for himself, but I think he said the same thing. Yes, Your Honor. So going back to, again, the statutory language in the statute for arbitration upon tenure charges is, again, just the threshold. It's not necessarily a limit on the arbitrator's power. As further stated, again, by the arbitrator, and there's a litany of case law, arbitration decisions, some reported Superior Court decisions, Fulcomer in particular being one historically, that a demotion is not explicitly impermissible in our system. And so we would submit that, again, with respect to this matter, the arbitration decision be, or rather the appellate division decision be overturned, the arbitration decision be reinstated. If the court were to rule in the negative on that matter, that the matter simply be remanded to the arbitrator with a clean slate to fashion a remedy with all options available, whether it be dismissal or removal, the terms are being used interchangeably, and or a financial penalty.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Schwartz, I invite you to incorporate any arguments that have already been made that don't need to be repeated. Mr. Hanlon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'd like to highlight two points from the decision below that we believe are critical to consideration of the issues we're discussing here today. Although the fact pattern in this case, which involved an administrator holding separate tenure in an instructional and an administrative position, is relatively rare in Teach NJ tenure decisions, the interpretation of the appellate division below goes much further than this uncommon factual scenario. The appellate division did not just say that an arbitrator is not permitted to demote a tenured employee under NJSA 18A:6-10. Quoting from the slip opinion of the appellate division, the arbitrator's award demoting San Juan is inconsistent with the disciplinary action set forth in NJSA 18A:6-10. That clear statutory mandate provides that tenure charges that are sustained against a tenured teaching staff member can only result in termination or depriving him or him of salary. And as Justice Wayne Raptor pointed out earlier, nowhere in the TEHL does it say those are the only two remedies or penalties that an arbitrator can impose. That's not in the statute. That's based on how the appellate division read 6-10, but there's no limitations on the remedies that an arbitrator can impose in elsewhere in the statute.
And is it your, do you agree with counsel for the school board that that arbitrators routinely impose remedies that are not expressly prescribed in statutes?
Correct, yes. When it went from the OAL to the Commissioner of Education, the State Board of Education, prior to 2012, there's plenty of decisions where there was remedies other than those two, than complete dismissal or reduction in salary. And since the Teach NJ Act amended the TEHL in 2012, there have been plenty of arbitration decisions taking a similar course. So it's sort of part of the industrial common law at this point that the remedies in tenure hearings can go outside of complete dismissal or reduction in salary. You know, some of the examples of this: psychological examination, a last chance agreement, professional development and training. Anger management. Sometimes the availability of these intermediate remedies, which are not specifically noted in the statute, will be the difference between a teacher's termination or reinstatement. It's our position that the appellate division's interpretation of 6-10 takes these remedies off the table, and that interpretation is contrary to the principle of progressive discipline because it removes the ability of an arbitrator to fashion an appropriate remedy based on the unique circumstances of each tenure case. So, for example, let's say we have, as a hypothetical, there's a wonderful teacher, long tenure in the district, has never been in trouble before, maybe yells at a student. The arbitrator considers the factors from In re Fulcamer, says, you know, I don't think this warrants termination, but I think this person, you know, I'm not totally comfortable. Or that they seek anger management courses or something along those lines, maybe the difference to putting that teacher back to work rather than removing them from employment. We'd also submit that this goes against the liberal view afforded to tenure statutes per this court's decision in Spivak versus Rutherford Board of Education from 1982. The second point I'd like to make is that the approach of the court below and
in terms of the first point, so you mentioned that there's been lots of cases where there's another remedy that is not complete dismissal or reduction in salary. Have any of those decisions been subject to a challenge for lack of statutory authority either before 2012 or after?
Not that I'm aware of. The second point I'd like to make is regarding the approach of the court below in interpreting the statute. We'd submit that that's contrary to how this court has approached that issue in the past. Quoting from page 17 of the slip opinion below, because our legislature chose not to include demotion as a penalty for a teaching staff member, an arbitrator has no authority to impose that form of disciplinary action upon finding that a Board of Education sustained tenure charges. In the past, this court has taken the opposite approach. As we quoted in our brief, in Scotch Plains Fanwood from 1995 and Linden Board of Education from 2010, This court's approach has been to permit an arbitrator to fashion an appropriate remedy unless the applicable CBA or statute that gives the arbitrator his or her authority expressly prohibits that remedy. In other words, a remedy need not be expressly included in a CBA or statute to be permissible within the arbitrator's authority. It just needs to not expressly be prohibited by the CBA or the statute. And that goes back to the point I made earlier about there are no limitations on the remedies that an arbitrator can provide in the TEHL. With just the short remaining time I have left, just addressing a couple points, Justice Patterson, you had, I believe you had made the point that there's more to the motion than a salary reduction, as the Chief Justice mentioned. You know, there's no dispute that an arbitrator certainly has the authority to completely terminate a tenured employee from their employment. Certainly, that's a much harsher result than a demotion, in which the employee is allowed to keep their job, keep their tenure, presumably probably not have the other effects of potential licensing issues or pension issues or that sort of thing. So it's a much lesser remedy. And I'd submit that the power to impose the most serious disciplinary penalty against an employee implies that a lesser discipline can also be applied against that employee. And Justice Noriega, you were asking about, you know, where do these remedies come from? And I'd submit that it's just part of the industrial common law that has developed over the past 100 years in labor arbitration and labor law itself. You know, the standard question in arbitration is there just cause for the penalty sought? If not, what's the remedy? So the standard issue in these cases always implies that, you know, there's the disciplinary penalty that the employee is seeking, and there's the possibility of a lesser penalty as well.
Obviously, the legislature has the ability and the authority to say, in this particular scenario, if it wanted to, there are only two remedies available other than dismissal of the charges.
Correct. And just the last point I'll make to that point is, so prior to the TEHNJ Act in 2012, it was the commissioner of the State Board of Education that had the authority to make final administrative decisions on tenure cases when they went before the ALJs. The commissioner's interpretation included these more intermediate remedies aside from a dismissal or reduction in salary. If the commissioner of education, the state board disagreed with those, it could have sought an amendment. It could have adjusted the interpretation. And as the court is aware, in 2012, the TEHNJ Act was a significant overhaul to large parts of the statute, not necessarily the substantive parts of the statute, which we know have been in place since 1967, the specific language dismissal or reduction in salary. But the legislature had a good long look at the TEHL. At that point, if it wanted to limit the remedies available to an arbitrator, it could have done that. The TEHL was amended again in 2015. I think the major change there was the arbitration list went from 25 to 50. Again, there was plenty of arbitration awards in the 2012 to 2015 period. The legislature wanted to amend it at that point to limit those remedies. They decided the intent was to just allow the two remedies of the two outcomes of dismissal or reduction in salary. It could have taken action then. So we'd submit that there's a long history. This is the accepted common law in this area, and that the appellate division below impermissibly changed that. As I mentioned, the decision below has serious significant consequences to how tenure hearings are going to operate in the future. And it's frankly created uncertainty in an area where there was no uncertainty before. In closing, we'd urge this court to reverse the decision below and continue the policy of affording arbitrators wide discretion with regard to crafting appropriate remedies based on the circumstances of each tenure hearing.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Schwartz.
Chief Justice, Associate Justices, may it please the court. We believe this matter is straightforward. We believe it's not complicated, and we're here today only because we believe the appellate division in a precedential decision issued a result that was incorrect as a matter of law. As noted in our brief, the appellate division imposed constraints that the legislature did not authorize. Specifically, the appellate division decision constrains arbitrators deciding tenure hearing law matters in three ways. First, an arbitrator can dismiss the charge totally for a want of evidence. The district doesn't satisfy its burden, the charge is dismissed. And two, sustaining the charge and fully terminating the employee from employment with the local board And then three, sustaining the charge, but only reducing the employee's salary. As these constraints are not found in the implementing legislation at all, the THL, the tenure hearing law, we ask this court to reverse and allow arbitrators the wide remedial authority that the legislature intended. First, as to the statute itself, the language of dismissal or reduction in pay that drove the appellate division's analysis, as Justice Apater noted, is only a filter. It's not a limit on an arbitrator's remedial authority. It's only a filter for which the commissioner to process a matter to arbitration. The language of dismissal or reduction in pay only appears three times in the statute. First, it appears in 18A 6-10, and in that section it says no tenured employee may be dismissed or reduced in pay, and I'm paraphrasing, without a hearing under this subarticle, that is the tenure hearing law. So I think we can all agree that the limitation there is not a limitation at all. It's just what the statute is designed to effectuate. In 6-11, the local board is the one operating under this filter, under this filtration process. The superintendent signs a tenure charge, which is sort of akin to an indictment, not a perfect analogy, but it's a sort of a charge against an employee that is under oath. The employee then provides a response and a position statement as to the charge. It's not true, here's why. And then the board receives that. And the board then reviews the position statement of the employee, the charge of the district and the superintendent, and determines whether, if the charge is true, would be sufficient for either a dismissal or a reduction in pay. If so, the board certifies the charge to the Commissioner of Ed, then the Commissioner of Ed performs that same filtration function, and that is in 6-16 of the statute. There, once the commissioner receives the charge, along with the statement of position from the employee, the commissioner performs the identical filtration function that the board previously did under 6-11. The commissioner reviews the charge to determine if true, it is sufficient for dismissal and pay, and therefore should be proceeding to arbitration. Otherwise, it is dissolved for insufficiency.
Is there a mechanism for the commissioner before, if that filtration system is the way the statute is designed, to demote the person short of dismissal or reduction in pay?
I don't believe so, Justice Noriega. The commissioner under the statute is permitted to entertain a motion for summary decision if the matter is not transferred to arbitration. I don't have the cite in the statute on that issue, but I do know that the tenure hearing law allows an employee to submit a motion for summary judgment right away. For example, the employee may say, these charges are not sufficient for either dismissal or reduction in pay. They allege something that's petty. The tenure hearing process is designed to remedy egregious conduct, and this doesn't meet the standard, so we're going to move to dismiss on a summary basis, and the commissioner can entertain that motion. The commissioner doesn't have to. The commissioner can entertain that motion and determine what's appropriate. So I think probably the answer to your question is yes, but I don't know for certain, Justice. But once the commissioner reviews the charge and determines that it is sufficient for either a dismissal or reduction in pay, the commissioner transfers the matter to an arbitration, and as I think Justice Patterson and Justice Apater noted, there's no limitation on the arbitrator's remedial authority. As Justice Perry-Louise said, the operating statute, once it goes to arbitration, is 17.1. And in that section, there are limits on what arbitrators can do, but none of those limitations reflect limits on their remedial authority. For example, an arbitrator must hold a hearing within 45 days of the assignment. The arbitrator must issue a decision within 45 days of the commencement of the hearing. The arbitrator can't receive more than $1,250 a day. The arbitrator, if the arbitrator wants an extension, the arbitrator needs to seek that from the commissioner. And critically, The arbitrator's decision is final and binding, subject only to a very, very limited judicial review. That is for judicial vocatur of an arbitration award under 2A 24-7 through 10. Thus, the language of dismissal or reduction in pay that drove the analysis of the appellate division was merely a filter. The filter by which a matter can go to arbitration. And I should note that pre-Teach NJ, this filter existed, except pre-Teach NJ, that is the tenure reform law that my colleagues discussed that was enacted in 2012, pre-Teach NJ, the commissioner still underwent that filtration function, but instead of transferring it to an arbitrator, the commissioner transferred it to an ALJ at the Office of Administrative Law. But importantly, the ALJ, when deciding a tenure case, issued an initial decision. And that initial decision was then affirmed, modified, or rejected by the commissioner. The commissioner, when reviewing an ALJ decision, could very well say, I disagree with this result. The board may argue that the result is wrong for these reasons. The employee may argue that the result is wrong for those reasons. And the commissioner may say, you know what? I disagree too, and I'm going to reverse. The commissioner can't do that now. The legislature took that power away when they made the arbitration award final and binding. Now, judges can't disagree with the result. There's no function for judicial review that allows any tribunal to disagree with an arbitrator unless it was perpetrated by bias, corruption, fraud, undue means, one of the delineated factors in 2A 24, 7 through 10. So if this case occurred pre-Teach NJ, I think the result should still be that the appellate division got it wrong. But post-Teach NJ, I think it's without question.
So, counsel, if not what your adversary is suggesting, what would qualify as an excess by the arbitrator under 2A:24-8E?
Well, for example, if the arbitrator told a vice principal that you're now going to be a custodian and you're going to be in charge of facilities, that would, I think, be outside the arbitrator's powers. The vice principal may not have a certain certification to do custodial work. The penalty that the arbitrator would have issued in this hypothetical, Justice Noriega, was not sought by the district. Of course, the district, when they're preferring tenure charges, always seeks dismissal or reduction in pay, as that is the standard for a district to issue tenure charges. I litigated a case years ago where the district did not seek a dismissal, where the district sought only a demotion from a principal position to a vice principal position. The arbitrator said that was improper on a motion to dismiss. The decision was not challenged. I'm not saying it's binding precedent, but I don't believe a district can use the tenure hearing process to effectuate what would be an internal demotion. The tenure hearing process is designed to effectuate egregious conduct because as a tenured administrator or a tenured teacher, you are essentially given a lot of protection from regular wrongdoing.
Wouldn't that hurt you in this case? In this case, what happened was the arbitrator ended up holding that there would be no dismissal. It would only be an internal demotion, as you just called it. So you're saying a school board cannot request that, but an arbitrator can impose it.
I believe that's correct, Justice.
Where in the statute would we learn that?
Where in the statute can we ascertain that a school district cannot request only...
That an arbitrator can still impose?
Well, because the arbitrator is not limited by any statutory criteria to impose his or her remedy.
What limits the advocate?
What limits the advocate, like the school board, from proceeding on only, say, for example, we think this conduct is egregious, but we don't think it's so egregious to warrant your full termination, and it only bears on your administrative service and not your teacher service, so we're going to use the tenure hearing process to remove you from the principal role and place you as the chemistry teacher? Is that your question, Chief Justice?
We get to the end of the hearing. Is the school board barred from saying we're satisfied with a demotion here?
I believe no, Your Honor, because once, if the school board is authorizing a tenure charge, that is seeking a full dismissal or a reduction in pay, and we go to the hearing, the commissioner reviews the charge, everything is sufficient, it processes to arbitration, is the school board barred from making a closing statement and saying, you know, in the alternative, arbitrator, we would accept just an internal demotion? I don't think so.
Either way, couldn't the school board just request a reduction in salary? And isn't that less than a demotion? I'm confused. It seems like if a school board wants to achieve a reduction in salary, it still has to go through this whole process, because under 610, it says that no tenured employee of a public school system shall be dismissed or reduced in compensation except for, and then it sets forth, if there is enough to get a dismissal or a reduction in compensation, you have to go to arbitration, and there's this whole thing. So why can't, I'm confused about why a school board wouldn't be able to simply request a reduction in salary.
They can. They can use this process to do exactly that, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the 6-10 statute that you referenced, the tenure hearing law, works in tandem with 18A, 28, 5, and 6, which is tenure acquisition. So tenure acquisition, 28, 5, and 6, says essentially that once you achieve tenure, once you meet the statutory delineated criteria for tenure acquisition, you cannot be dismissed or reduced in pay unless the process of 6-10 is followed.
It doesn't matter for this case, but I'm not sure I understood your answer. These charges could have proceeded exactly the way that they did. Your position is that everyone understood that the arbitrator had the ability to use demotion as the remedy. But the school board could not have said at the end of the hearing, we've now heard everything. That's what we want as well.
No, I believe they could have.
Thank you.
I believe they could have, and I apologize if I wasn't clear on that.
The ultimate decision would be for the arbitrator as to what the remedy
is. The ultimate decision would, in fact, be for the arbitrator, but the school board can seek dismissal at the outset. And then, like any prosecutor,
a demotion at the outset, because they can also seek a reduction in salary at the outset, and a demotion is more than a reduction in salary, or somewhere between a reduction in salary and a dismissal.
In the matter of
not less than a reduction in salary, right? You'd be demoted without being reduced in salary.
Let me just say that I think if you are reduced in your salary, that is effectively a form of demotion. I agree with your point, Justice. The matter of McCormick, which is a pre-TSHNJ case and did not go to the appellate division, is instructive. It's cited in the briefs. It is an old case. It is indeed pre-TSHNJ, so I don't know how instructive it will be. But in that case, the district, I forget which district, it's cited in the brief. In my brief, my colleague Lester Taylor's brief as well, and perhaps NJA's brief, and maybe even the employee brief, the school district used the tenure hearing process to remove an employee from one higher position to a lower tenured position.
The significance of the case is that the commissioner had no problem with that and affirmed what the ALJ did.
Indeed.
In view of the hour, is there anything additional that you would like to present?
I'd just like to emphasize that it's very important, bless you, Justice, that it's very important to recognize that another reason the appellate division's analysis was incorrect is because of the framing, using the word demotion to drive the entire analysis. The district got the result of a dismissal. It was just not a complete and total dismissal from employment. Now, Justice Noriega asked a question before about removal versus dismissal. Is it the same? Dismissal seems to have a more finite sort of designation to it. I would disagree, Justice. If you're a tenured employee, you can't be removed from your position. You can't be dismissed from your position unless tenure charges are sustained against you. And so in this case, we have a vice principal who was removed from her vice principal position and placed in her teaching position. Now, my colleague representing the employee says that her tenure wasn't stripped. Respectfully, that conclusion represents a fundamental misunderstanding of how the tenure laws operate. If you are removed from a tenured position, you don't have tenure in that position anymore. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been removed. So the employee can be dismissed from that one position. And the appellate division analysis, I think, failed to recognize or appreciate that this was, in fact, a dismissal. So if the court is inclined to view the language as, or the language of, dismissal or reduction in pay as a limitation on the arbitrator's remedial authority, the result below was fully consistent with that result because it indeed was a dismissal. And finally, allowing this result is fully consistent with the spirit of the tenure law. As my colleague from NJEA said, you earn tenure individually and separately under 28.5 and 28.6. And so it stands to reason and logic that it can be removed separately under 6-10. And finally, this approach comports with the public policy announced by this court that the tenure laws should be liberally construed to achieve their beneficent ends. I'm happy to answer any other questions. I know I'm over my time, Justice. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Goldman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice and Associate Justices. Appellate division got it right. Now, why do I say that? Well, if you look at the title of Section 18A:6-10, it says dismissal and reduction in compensation of persons under tenure in public school system. It doesn't say dismissal, comma, demotion, comma, and or reduction in compensation. It says dismissal or reduction in compensation. That was the basis of the appellate division's opinion in this case. They said that the arbitrator, Mr. Zirkel, in using the words demoted, because it was his words, demoted, exceeded his authority, which is one of the criteria that you can appeal from an arbitrator's decision. He exceeded his authority by demoting her. Why? Because the statute doesn't say no person shall be dismissed or demoted or reduced in compensation. Now,
counsel, is there a statute you can point us to that expressly says arbitrators only have the power to dismiss or reduce compensation and nothing else?
The only thing you can go by, Your Honor, is what I just quoted from, which
that's
is...
That's not a statement in that statute about the arbitrator's authority, is it?
Well, it's the only person that can make that decision, arbitrator.
Is there, I'll ask it again, because I want your help on this. Is there language you can point us to that expressly limits what the arbitrator can do?
No, the statute doesn't say, per se, any statute within this tenure laws doesn't say an arbitrator can only dismiss or reduce in salary. But the whole process, the only individual or body that can make that decision is an arbitrator. An administrative law judge can't do it. The commissioner of education can't do it. So the only person that can do it is an arbitrator.
Actually, in the statute, if there's a motion for summary decision, the commissioner retains the case. Isn't that correct? Under 16-16?
I'm not sure if there's ever been a summary decision under the new Teach Act.
Well, that's what it says, though. It says, if, however, the commissioner shall determine that such charge is sufficient to warrant dismissal or reduction of salary, he shall refer the case to an arbitrator, except that when a motion for summary decision has been made prior to that time, the commissioner may retain the matter for purposes of deciding the motion. So in that instance, the commissioner does retain the case and decides the motion for summary decision. What options are available to the commissioner in that scenario?
No, the only options they have, because it's before the matter is given to an arbitrator. So the only options that the commissioner has is to either grant it or deny the summary disposition. If he or she denies the summary disposition, then it then gets referred to an arbitrator whose powers are then limited by what I just described.
When you say, are you saying it's a summary dismissal, not a summary disposition? Meaning they cannot remove the teacher. They can just say, there's nothing here.
Yes.
This case is going away.
Yes.
Or
yes.
They can send it to an arbitrator.
Right, right. So it's, you know, that's the gatekeeper, so to speak. So the Commissioner of Education is the gatekeeper in terms of whether there is enough evidence to at least then submit it to an arbitrator. Once it's submitted to an arbitrator, the commissioner is completely out of the picture.
Right, but I'm talking about that last portion of the statute. So the first portion of that paragraph discusses a scenario in which the commissioner does not think there's sufficient to warrant dismissal or salary reduction, and that's done, right?
Right.
The case is done. So I understand in that instance, nothing happens, nothing goes further.
Right.
But the statute says if the commissioner does determine that such charge is sufficient to warrant dismissal or salary reduction, if there's a motion for summary decision, then the commissioner retains the matter for purposes of deciding that the motion for summary decision.
That's correct. Now, I have never seen that occur pre or post any of the tenure laws. So I'm not sure how that would play out, because if there's a decision by a summary decision by the commissioner, then you can appeal it in the normal course and to the appellate division, and then it would be the normal way to decide that against the weight of the evidence. In other words, the appellate division wouldn't be limited the same way they're limited to when an arbitrator decides a matter, because that is one of the key elements in this particular case. Once they passed the THL statute, giving the power to the arbitrators, it wanted to at least, it gives power to the arbitrators, but at the same time, no decision's ever been made as to how broad those powers are.
What about McCormick, which of course is a dated case where the teacher was demoted from a tenured administrative position to a teaching position. And when the ALJ's decision went up to the commissioner said, that's fine.
Again, that's pre-Teach Act case. That is...
So what changed in the statute that meant that before it used to be that the remedies were dismissal, reduction in salary, reinstatement on the condition of completing a fitness for duty assessment or psychiatric evaluation or training about appropriate physical conduct in schools or probation or a last chance basis? What changed that all of that used to be okay and now it's not? Where in the statute can we see that the legislature said, there will be no more remedies, none of these creative intermediate remedies. There will only be dismissal or reduction in salary forever going forward.
Well, we don't know whether that would have been okay if it ever went up to the appellate division or up to this Supreme Court.
We agree that it happened for decades, correct? Not only the case that the Chief Justice read about, we heard that there have been many cases where there was a decision that was not dismissal or reduction in salary, including reinstatement to the last tenured position on a probationary or last chance basis, reinstatement on the condition of anger management counseling, reinstatement on the condition of completing a fitness for duty assessment. Are you disagree that all of those cases have imposed those remedies?
Obviously, the cases impose those penalties. But here's the main difference, in my opinion. And this is what makes the arbitration process, where you have people that are arbitrators that are not directly involved in the New Jersey school system making these decisions. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that this is a very small school system. That the school system, again, this is a hypothetical. Small school system, there's an assistant principal who was previously a French teacher in the school system. very small school system. So she becomes an assistant principal. Now there's another French teacher, right? The school system has one French teacher in the entire school system. She's an assistant principal. Now there's another French teacher. Arbitrator gets the case and says, you know what? I'm not going to dismiss you. I'm going to demote you back to being a French teacher. What does the school system do now?
I understand that might put the school system in an odd position, but it has nothing to do with this case, and the statute doesn't say anything about it. My question was, what allowed those intermediate creative remedies under the pre-2012 system, but disallowed them under the post-2012 system?
Maybe they shouldn't have been allowed.
So you're saying all for decades, even under the commissioner's decisions, those have all been wrong? Well,
if you look carefully at those decisions, a lot of the most, if not all the decisions say, we're going to partially uphold the tenure charges. Partially uphold, and this is the condition. Condition is fitness for duty. Condition is last chance. The condition is psychological counseling. We're going to partially uphold these decisions. That is not what happened here.
But either way, the statute doesn't say that that is explicitly allowed, and your argument here is that it cannot happen unless the statute explicitly says that it can happen.
That is my argument, yes, because the only wording that you have, again, in my opinion, you can't go back to what commissioners of education did because now it's completely out of their hands. The only wording that you have is that no person shall be dismissed or reduced in compensation.
Could the arbitrator have found that the charges were not sustainable against your client?
Absolutely.
That's not listed in the statute. Where's the authority for the arbitrator to make that finding?
It says no person shall be dismissed unless X, Y, and Z. So the only way you can dismiss an individual who has tenure is to remove tenure. Once you remove tenure, the school board is at liberty to dismiss that person however they want to do that. You can't do that under the tenure law.
So, I'm sorry, I didn't make myself clear. Could they have dismissed the charges against your client? Not dismissed your client, dismissed the charges, saying that there wasn't sufficient to find that she should be dismissed or reduced in pay?
Absolutely. That's what the whole tenure hearing is about.
That's not listed anywhere explicitly in the statute, that finding that the arbitrator has that authority. The commissioner has that authority to sustain whether or not it is subject to dismissal or subject to reduction of pay. But that authority does not apply to the arbitrator in this statute.
Well, my argument is that it does because, again, the only person that can make the decision once it gets past the gatekeeper, the only person that can make the decision as to whether a person shall be dismissed or reduced in compensation is the arbitrator. And then it goes through the different categories which they can find.
You
the
just
point is,
the commissioner being a gatekeeper, is that pursuant to 6-16?
Well, they called it a filter, I call it a gatekeeper.
So you agree that the purpose of 6-16 is only a gatekeeper, whether or not it goes to arbitration?
That would be my position, yes.
So then where do we find in the statute anything that restricts the arbitrator's ability to impose any remedy that they want? If you just agreed that 6-16 is a gatekeeper only about whether it gets to arbitration, then where is the statute that says once it's at arbitration, the arbitrator can only impose X or Y as a remedy?
I go back to 6-10. And we may have a disagreement on it, but 6-10 talks about when an individual can be dismissed or reduced in compensation, not dismissed, demoted, and reduced in compensation. And again, the only person that can make that decision is the arbitrator.
Counsel, Mr. Taylor graciously danced around the question about what you said when the arbitrator asked, can I demote at the end of the hearing? What did you say?
I'm glad you asked that question because I think we also have to talk about what happened at the beginning of the hearing. There was never a claim.
I'm going to start with the end of the hearing.
Okay, fine. The end of the hearing, the only thing the arbitrator asked, and Mr. Taylor was not present at the hearing, it was an associate of his. The only thing that the arbitrator asked was, can he do something short of taking away her tenure? And both of us cited Folkemer, not for the purpose of demotion, but on the purpose of exactly what Folkemer stands for, which is basically you can withhold an increment, you can increase the suspension, right? The original suspension was a certain amount of time. The arbitrator did increase the suspension. After he came out with his decision, he said, okay, she can be reinstated within 60 days. So that increased her suspension. We both agreed that that was the limit as to what he could do. And the reason why I said, Justice Patterson, about let's start about the beginning, because it was never the district's position, never, or else maybe it would have been argued and maybe we wouldn't be here, that she had two tenures and that both tenures should be removed, both as an administrator and both as a teacher.
But you agree that as a matter of law, she did, because that's just how tenure works, correct? Or do you disagree that you
had separate tenure
and separate positions?
She had two tenures. I don't know whether you call her teacher tenure to be basically in abeyance right now, because I don't know how it works once you have two tenures. The one case, the Petrella case, it's a little bit different because he had tenure as a athletic director and tenure as a teacher, and he could do both at the same time. You can't be both an assistant principal and a teacher at the same time. So, yes, she had two tenures. I don't know how that would have been handled, but that was never, ever presented to the arbitrator. The only thing that was presented to the arbitrator was her tenure as an assistant principal. Never argued by the district. Never argued by the district that, you know what, if you don't want to remove her tenure as an assistant principal, or if you don't want to fire her completely, just remove her tenure as an assistant principal. But we're arguing that both tenures should be removed. They never argued that. They wanted her fired. They thought by just removing her tenure as an assistant principal, that that would have achieved what they wanted. And if that occurred, then what would they say now about two tenures? I would have argued, hey, if the arbitrator granted that and removed her tenure as a assistant principal and then decided to fire her, I would say, you can't fire her. She still has tenure as a teacher.
But that is what happened. The arbitrator just took away her tenure as an administrator. And so your argument won. Her tenure as a teacher remained.
He never even considered that, the arbitrator. The arbitrator never even considered the fact that she had two tenures because it was never argued. It was not in the realm of any argument. You look at the entire record. You look at the post-hearing briefs. You look at anything that occurred in this case. And nobody ever argued that she had two tenures and that both should be removed.
Since the arbitrator's award, has she had tenure as a teacher?
Well, she retains tenure as a teacher. Well, since the arbitrator's award, she was put back in her position as a teacher. Then after the appellate division ruled,
I think I'm reading from the arbitrator's decision where it specifically says that plaintiff's conduct warranted loss of the administrative position, but also, quote, retention of her tenured teaching role in the district. So it seems like you just said, no, the arbitrator did not do that. He did not remove her only from her administrative role and then leave her in the tenure of her teaching position. But it seems like the arbitrator is saying that is exactly what I'm doing.
No, he demoted her, though. He didn't say he's removing tenure.
He phrased it as, quote, retention of her tenured teaching role in the district.
And then I think he also goes on saying he...
1 to 22, I think.
No, I do remember that. But I think he also goes on to say that he doesn't even know what authority he has to do that. I believe he mentions that somewhere in his decision. But be that as it may, again, what he did was, and again, that's the position of the amici, but not the position of the district. The position of the amici is, hey, she had two tenures. All he really did was take away one tenure, which is the same thing as simply a reduction in salary. That's what their argument was, if you read their briefs. The district is not saying that. Why isn't the district saying that? Because that was never their argument. That was never their argument. Their argument was simply, hey, she has, quote, tenure. Please remove her tenure, and therefore, we can then fire her.
Regardless of their argument, if that's the ultimate finding, that the respondent's conduct in question warrants retention of her tenured teaching role in the district, as Justice Wainwright just read and as it's in the award, does that change your argument at all?
No. Why? Because I still go by the statute 18A:6-10, which, in my opinion and my simple reading, limits the authority of the arbitrator to either dismiss or remove tenure or reduce in compensation.
What is your response to Amicus's argument that your reading of the statute eliminates the possibility of progressive discipline?
That doesn't limit the possibility. Nothing in the statute limits the possibility of progressive.
Your argument is that the statute gives two possible outcomes, complete dismissal or reduction in salary.
Or removal of tenure. Removal of dismissal, of charges. Okay.
By way of dismissal.
Right, right.
So
dismissal of charges,
dismissal or reduction in salary.
Right. Three possible results, right? Dismissal of charges, removal of tenure, which then permits them to terminate, or reduction in salary, which is usually withholding of an increment or an additional suspension, which is consistent with the Fulcamer decision.
So suspension falls within that category of possible discipline.
That's reduction in salary. An additional suspension is, in essence, a reduction in salary because you're not going to get paid during that period of time. So that's really what the reduction in compensation.
So all the other possible remedies and disciplines that your colleagues on the other side have discussed, those are not a possibility. In cases where there might be a stellar teacher that for the first time had, you know, one incident, and maybe an arbitrator decides that suspension, neither suspension or reduction in salary or dismissal is warranted, those are not an option.
I agree with that. Yes, I agree. And I agree. And I think there's a reason for that. Once you give the decision-making process to an arbitrator, that should limit what he or she is able to do, again, pursuant to my reading of the statute, because you have very, very limited chance to appeal that. Once it was heard previously by an administrative law judge, you could argue, hey, it was against the weight of the evidence. You know, or we know that based upon law, right, the commissioner of education by him or herself could overturn what the administrative law judge said and could impose his or her own penalty, right? We don't have that anymore. It definitely streamlines the process, but in streamlining the process, it should also limit what an arbitrator can or cannot do. My position is the statute is clear as to what he or she can't do, which is that, again, if the legislature wanted to give power to the arbitrator to demote or to do anything else, they could have simply added the words in 18A:6-10 that no person shall be dismissed or demoted or reduced in compensation or anything else. They could have done that, but they didn't do that.
So you're relying heavily on Section 10, of course.
I'm relying upon it just as the appellate division relied upon it in deciding the case and in realizing that there was no other decision that ever defined what an arbitrator can do or what this statute means other than the simple reading of the statute.
And Section 10 was enacted long before TeachNJ in 1967.
That's correct.
So all of the cases that did not follow the route that you've outlined for us are violative of the statute as you understand it.
They may have been. I again, it's hard to say what any appellate division would have done. if that issue was raised beforehand, but it provided, there was a many things were different before the Teach Act. As I indicated, right, we had the administrative law judge making a decision. The commissioner could have either rubber stamped it or made some other decision, and then it could have been an appeal to the appellate division where there would be different standards for review, right? It's a lot different now, and that is what the appellate division found, that it's much different when you limit someone's power as to what they can or cannot do, and that person, they didn't indicate it, but in my opinion, that person is not part of the New Jersey State school system, then their power should be limited. And as the appellate division stated, the statute, while it doesn't say an arbitrator cannot dismiss or can only dismiss or reduce in compensation, that's the only person that can reduce or dismiss in compensation is an arbitrator. That limits his or her ability to do anything different.
Anything else you'd like to add?
I have nothing further. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
And thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court is in recess.